I'm Elliot Forrest. In for Leonard Lopate, Michael Moore's film Bowling for Columbine won the Academy Award for Best Documentary in 2003, and that film, along with Fahrenheit 9/11 and Sicko, are among the highest-grossing documentaries of all time. He's also written the bestsellers Dude, Where's My Country? And Stupid White Men. His latest effort, Here Comes Trouble, Stories from My Life, provides us with glimpses into his childhood and how he became the Michael Moore we all know and many love. It's just out from Grand Central Publishing, and it's a pleasure to welcome Michael Moore back to the show. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Elliot. Thank you for having me.
Is this as close as you've come to an autobiography?
Oh, yeah. I've never written about, really, I think, any of these stories before. Made reference to them in a couple of places, a couple of the stories. But no, these are stories I wanted to, been writing down and wanting to write about or tell for many, many years. Thought I would be able to someday. And then I got the idea a couple of years ago that, what I'd really like to do is write a book of short stories, because I love the form. I love reading short stories. And I thought, why don't I write these stories for my life? And these are all virtually all before I made my first film. So this is a part of my life that the public knows nothing about. But I'll write them as short stories, but they'll be nonfiction short stories. So this will be a book of short stories that are not works of fiction, but are actually true. And they're from my life, or based on my life, or based on events in my life, or whatever. So that's what I did. And that's what this is two dozen short stories that take you on a kind of a interesting, strange ride through a kid that grew up in the Midwest.
And I want to get to at least touch on many of them. You start, though, with something called The Execution of Michael Moore, which is kind of you and kind of someone else. It starts with a quote from Glenn Beck that he was thinking about killing you or wanted to kill you. Were you surprised, especially then, that your work has elicited so much animosity from people?
Yes, I was. Glenn Beck made that statement on the radio back in 2005 after Fahrenheit 9/11 came out. And just one day he just goes off on this rant about, I'm thinking about killing Michael Moore. And I think, I don't know if I would do it myself or if I'd hire somebody to do it, but I think it has to be done. And I do wear this band that says, what would Jesus do? But I don't think about that anymore because I'm so upset. And I just think it would be all right. It would be right and okay to kill him. And there was a lot of that talk about me, in the right-wing media at the time on Fox News. Bill O'Reilly made some crack one night about that he's personally against the death penalty, except for Michael Moore. It's easy to laugh about it now, but at the time, what it did, unfortunately, when you put that stuff out there into a deranged mind or two or hundred that are listening to it, it obviously has an effect and had a severe effect on me because I essentially came down to daily assaults or attempted assaults on me randomly. Just people would see me on the sidewalk.
And we're not talking just verbally here.
Oh, no. God, no, I can take that. You can yell at me as much as you want. These are people who came at me with clubs, knives, pens, pencils, people trying to tackle me. There was this one incident down in Fort Lauderdale where this guy, it was a nicely dressed guy, actually was in a suit. And he sees me and his face turns purple and you could just see the chip in his head that's, tuned into the Rush Limbaugh show or Glenn Beck or whatever. He just sees me and his just goes insane. He had a Starbucks cup in his hand. He took the lid off and threw hot scalding coffee at my face. At the time, I've been through so much of this that, I had to get these security guys and the security guy saw this happening, and he didn't have time to stop the guy, so he put his face in front of mine and took the hit and got second-degree burns all over his face, but not before, grabbing the guy and taking him down. But it was either random.
I hate to make light of it, but did they have the conversation, would you take a coffee for Michael Moore?
Yeah, that's... I never asked them that question. If they had, if it was decaf, maybe they would. I don't know. But
this is horrific. Did you start the book in 2003? And let's remind people the historical time frame, where that was, where we were as a country, and where we were as far as going to war, and then what you said when you gave your acceptance speech.
That's very important to because memory fades quickly on issues like this. I gave that Oscar speech. It was, I think, the fifth day of the war, and I and those who were opposed to it were in the minority. A very small. I mean, I think there was 80% approval for Bush and 70% approval for the war. It was very big. And in fact, I was very alone when it came to other liberal commentators or people that were that you would expect to not support George W. Bush in this war. So sticking my neck out like that at a time when people like, say, Al Franken were for the war, David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, was for the war, Bill Keller, became editor of The New York Times, was a columnist then, was for the war. I think 27, 29 Democratic U.S. senators voted for the war. Including John Kerry. There were many liberals in favor of this war. And so I was even isolated from that mainstream liberal thinking. And so I said what I said when I accepted the Oscar. We were living in fictitious times with a president elected with fictional election results.
And this is how you started, right? You didn't say thank you to the Academy. You just launched into it, right?
No, I know. In years hence, I thought it might have gone over better had I just like maybe thanked the Academy, thanked the person who did my wardrobe, my hair, my agent.
None of that.
No, because you've got 45 seconds, just looking at the clock. And actually, I thought I had come up with something that was somewhat poetic. I just said, I invited my fellow nominees up on the stage. It's the only time in 75 years of the Oscars at that time that the winner invited the other four in his category up to share the stage with him. So they came up with me. I told them during the commercial break, just in case I win, if you don't mind, I'm going to say something and I'd love for you to join me if you want to. And they all did. And then I said, we make nonfiction. That's what we do for a living, those of us on this stage. But we don't live in nonfiction times. We live in fictitious times. We live in times where a story has been made up about weapons of mass destruction, and we are sending our young people over to die for a piece of fiction. And of course, the place went nuts, and lots of boos, and
you weren't a big hit.
I was not a big hit, no. And in the post game shows afterwards on the networks and after the Oscars, especially out in L.A., it was all about that's the end of Michael Moore. Well, that's the last we'll see of him, And I was really persona non grata. I walked into the governor's ball, and practically everybody that was like the Red Sea, everybody parted and wanted to stay.
Not everybody though,
but not everybody. That's right, because one individual starts walking toward me, and I see that Sherry Lansing, who at that time was the head of Paramount Pictures, and I thought, oh, geez, she's just going to give it to me here. One of the big six studios, and the top people here run this town. And she walked right up to me and gave me a hug and planted a big kiss on my cheek and said, thank you for saying what you said. And then she whispered in my ear, she said, this hurts now, but it won't. And in time, you will see that people will come around. And she was right. Within 2 or 3 years, the majority of Americans had changed their position on the war once they figured out the truth. And I was no longer out on that limb and was in the mainstream majority opinion of the country.
I'm Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate. Today, my guest is Michael Moore. His new book is called Stories from My Life. Here Comes Trouble. Great title. The chapter we were just talking about is actually about the execution of Michael Moore, but that's not you. Somebody wrote you a letter. Who's the other Michael Moore?
A man on death row in Texas. I got a letter one day. It was addressed to Michael Moore from Michael Moore. And I opened it up, and he had not known of me at that time. This was back around year 2000, 2001. And they had shown my only fiction film, Canadian Bacon, to the inmates the night before. Don't know if it was supposed to be torture or some kind of, I love the film.
But it was either that or waterboarding.
It was, yes. But he said, I saw your name in the film and that's my name. And so I thought, could you help me? Because they're going to kill me. And so I started a campaign to try and get his execution put aside. And succeeded in one of the rare instances where someone on death row was granted a stay in Texas. And for the better part of that year, 2001, I tried to drum up support and whatever for his case. Then 9/11 happened. And after, the month after that, they were just like, nobody cared about helping somebody who was a murderer.
What had he done?
He had broken into a house to steal some things and was confronted by the woman who lived in the house, and he killed her. And so he was not an innocent, as you would say. But I was raised with a certain set of beliefs that, first of all, we do not behave as those who we those we despise in terms of their actions, what they do, we don't do those actions ourselves, because then we become, in effect, them. And we don't have the right to take another human life unless it's an actual specific self-defense. I've always thought that the death penalty was wrong. New York Times did a great story a few years ago about how I live in one of the 10, well, it was at the time one of the 10, I think now there's 12 states that don't have the death penalty. The state of Michigan was the first English-speaking government in the world to eliminate the death penalty back in the 1840s. And in those 10 to 12 states that don't have the death penalty, we actually have lower murder rates than the states that have the death penalty. So it's not a deterrent.
Is it on religious or moral grounds that you're anti-death penalty?
Well, I don't know if I make the distinction between those two words, but both, I guess, is the answer. I am a Catholic, and that is one of the few positions of the institution that I agree with. The institution is against the death penalty, but also I just don't think I have that right, and you don't have that right. We do have a right to protect ourselves, absolutely. But to take another life—that's really just an act of revenge, and that does not take us to a higher place of consciousness and or being in terms of us as human beings with a soul, and to behave like that is just. I think at some point historians will look back on this and just wonder, whoa, the way we look at the barbarians, they'll think why they were getting so civilized, it seemed. But then they'll go, well, they weren't that civilized. They had atomic weapons and holocausts and things like that.
So. The other Michael Moore, this guy in jail, he was put to death.
Yes, he was. He was.
Did he ask you to attend?
Yes, he did. He did. I could not do that. I could not go. And
you just didn't want to be there.
I just could not watch someone die. And I felt bad. He wanted that, and I wanted to do something that was good for him. But I think, and this is one of many instances in the book where I'm just being honest. I am just me, and I'm not a perfect soul, and I don't always have the wherewithal or conviction or bravery or whatever to do the things that need to be done. I try to as much as I can, but that isn't always the case. There's sort of an arc in these. I mean, this isn't an autobiography in that sense, because these are actual short stories that are separate from each other. But if you read it in order, you'll see that, I through my childhood and being in high school or whatever, I am witness to a number of things where things start to click, and I realize, well, I can't be silent about this. This is just, to be silent is to, be part of it.
You had a best friend in high school, a girl named Zoe.
Yeah.
Tell us a story there.
I put this story in the book. This is a very personal story, but it's there mainly for the younger generation these days who's never lived during a time when abortion was illegal, and many women were hurt and suffered and because of illegal abortion, sometimes died. And in this instance, this very close friend of mine in high school got pregnant and decided to get an illegal abortion. excuse me. And of course, you know, it was botched, and she ended up in the hospital. And I tell the story of you know, what I did to help her, and didn't know whether she was going to live or die, and all that. But it was quite a harrowing thing at 16 or 17 years old to have to go through. And thinking, you know, at the time we're just thinking, God, if we only lived in New York because it was legal here. This would have been 1971, I think, somewhere around there. And we didn't. And we tried to make a big plan to come to New York City. How could we drive from Flint, Michigan to New York? How could we make this happen? How could we raise the money? And it was just impossible. And then finally I convinced her we can at least get gas money. We can get to Buffalo. so she said she would, her and her boyfriend would go to Buffalo. And in fact, they did. And they went to Detroit. And so that was, that's what happened. It's one of the stories in the book. When I've gone back to reread it, it's emotional to me personally to think about that time, and then to think about the time in which we live. That even though abortion is still legal, it's actually we don't know this here in New York, but in other parts of the country, there are whole states where there's maybe one doctor that will do this procedure anymore. So in effect, they have outlawed abortion and gotten around the Supreme Court decision.
You dedicate this book to your mother. Tell us about her as a personality, as your mom, and her influence on you.
Well, she taught me to read and write at the age of four, which is probably the best gift that she ever gave me. I was reading books before I went to kindergarten, and that was great. It was great in terms of opening my mind and the sort of creative thing that starts to get unleashed. The bad thing about it is that you have to sit there in the Bluebird group. While all the other kids are singing their ABCs, and you're like already, you know, reading, you know, little books and whatever. So the nuns saw that, and they felt bad for me. So they decided to skip me up a grade one day. They just suddenly moved me from first grade to second grade one day. And I was so thrilled, and I came home and told my parents, and they're like, "You're going right back to first grade." I'm going, "Why? No, don't make me go back there. I'm so bored." No, you need to be with children your own age, you know. And so they called the mother superior, and I had to go back. I had to go back to first grade. But my mom was, you know, her idea of a summer vacation for us kids was to take us to Washington D.C. and walk us through the National Archives, and the Smithsonian, and the FBI tour in the Justice Department, and then we had to go meet our congressmen and our senators, and we did that every couple years, so she instilled in me the importance of that. And her dad was was one of the leaders of the Republican Party in the town where I grew up. And my mom was a Republican too until it came time for Reagan. And then she could not go that far because the old school Republicans actually were quite decent people. I mean, when they said conservative, they meant conserve your money. Don't spend money you don't have. Conserve the environment, the air, the water. You know, Teddy Roosevelt, great Republican. You know, that was one of our first conservationists. That's what conservative meant to them. That Republican Party is so far gone, and I feel bad for those who consider themselves to be conservatives but have really nowhere to go right now because their party has been hijacked by, you know, well...
It's
lunatics.
it's easy to see the influence on your mom in you and your upbringing, particularly in this book. We're going to take a break. I just want one quick question, maybe a brief answer. Eric in Brooklyn writes in, "Do you have any regrets about anything you've ever said in public about any issue?"
No, you know, I was asked on the Today Show this morning, did I regret giving that Oscar speech? And I thought what I really wanted to say was, no, actually, I'm waiting for NBC, ABC, CBS, and most of the mainstream media to offer their regrets for not having really checked out what we were being told. I mean, that's why we need our media, our free press. You're there as the bulwark against the BS, to let the people know the truth about what's being told to us. And instead, they got embedded and they got on board And they didn't do their job. They fell through. I mean, Bill Keller in the Times this past week gave his own apology for that. I have no regrets for that. My only regrets, as I express in the book, is that it brought an unusual amount of violence toward me and my family, that I just feel bad putting them through that, and have often questioned whether I would do it again if I knew that they would have to go through what I've had to go through.
I'm talking to Michael Moore about his book, Here Comes Trouble, Stories from My Life. It's published by Grand Central Publishing, and we'll have more right after a break. Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate. Today my guest is Michael Moore. His book is called Stories from My Life, Here Comes Trouble. We were talking before the break about the influence of your mother. You also account her death and in dealing with the hospital situation at the time. Was there a connection between your mother's death and making the movie Sicko about the hospital industry?
I wasn't even going to include this story actually in this book, because I wanted this to be just stories from before I made Roger and Me. And but I started writing this story called Pietà about our trip to the World's Fair here in 1965 in New York, and the stop that we made in Washington, D.C. on the way. And that just led to thinking about her last trip to New York and how she wanted to go down to the World Trade Center a few weeks or so after the attack, and I tried to talk her out of it, and she wanted to go. And you know, she always came to. We had an aunt that lived on Staten Island, so we always drove from Michigan every other year or so when we were kids, and became very familiar with New York. And she and my aunt and my cousin were, we loved New York as kids from Flint, Michigan, and we took the ferry over from Staten Island and wandered the city. And I was just thinking today, again, when I was on the Today Show, how just at 9 years old, you know, pressing my nose up against the glass when watching the Today Show back then, back when you could actually stand up to the glass and press your nose against it. And just the whole, man, New York was just a great place. And we loved coming here. And so, and she loved it. And she wanted to go down to see the site, and so finally I took her down there, and it really she got very sad and started crying, and I just thought, why did I do this? You know, she's in the final years of her life, and she just loves New York, and I don't want her leaving the world thinking that this is the world she's leaving behind. This is the new world order. And then that led into me writing about the situation in the hospital and the decisions that quickly had to be made, and then her death. And I decided to include it in this book. Sicko, the film, which I did 5 years later, really the focus of that was really more about the insurance companies and how they are true machines of evil. if we were a saner, kinder nation, we would outlaw, you know, private health insurance companies. We wouldn't allow people to make a profit off people's sicknesses and illnesses and tragedies. I mean, it's just a sick, sick system.
We have a rather provocative question from Adam from Columbia University. I'm assuming you won't have an opinion on this at all. What does he think of Citizens United, how he thinks it'll affect politics in the future, and how Michael thinks ordinary citizens can keep control of the electoral process out of the hands of big business?
Wow. Well, Citizens United, probably one of the worst decisions the Supreme Court has made in my lifetime, because it really ultimately handed the reins of control of our democratic government over to the rich, to Wall Street, to big business. And now they can literally not have to hide it. They can, and not have to be restrained in any way. They can, I mean, we already knew they bought our politicians, but now they can just be upfront about it and literally just run the whole show. It's something that has to be overturned by law or by constitutional amendment. I was personally annoyed during the whole discussion and debate and then listening to the Supreme Court arguments that day by Citizens United, where they cited me and Fahrenheit 9/11 as one of the foundations of their lawsuit, of their argument, saying that, well, if Michael Moore can make Fahrenheit 9/11, and that's not considered, you know, he doesn't have to file with the FEC on that, why should we have to? Of course, they were making a specific anti-Hillary film to, you know, because they're pushing their candidate. Fahrenheit 9/11, I've never met John Kerry. I've never had anything to do with his campaign, never spoke to them, nothing, you know. And we started making that film before there even was a John Kerry. That film is really about the war and about our response after 9/11 and how we were going down the wrong road and how people were being manipulated with fear. I mean, and it was a movie. It wasn't an ad for anything other than just, you know, it was my personal take on what was going on. And the Supreme Court bought that argument, and they gave the equivalency to the Citizens United film ad on Hillary and Fahrenheit 9/11.
So it's your fault, basically.
Oh, I've never said that publicly, but I, because then I would regret it. But I would, I have felt really bad that somehow I felt kind of helpless. Like I couldn't, I wish I could have just run into the courtroom there and just, wait a minute. But the fix was in, because this Supreme Court is, we have a stacked court of ideologues who have been hell-bent on upending any good thing that's happened in the last 70 years in this country.
I'm Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate. The guest is Michael Moore. His new book is Stories from My Life. Here Comes Trouble. If you want to know the beginnings and how Michael Moore became Michael Moore, it's in this book. I was curious to see that you started a newspaper when you were very young in Flint, the Flint Voice, and you were starting to do sting operations in a way. Was this the beginning of the kind of ambush techniques that you would then eventually take into your films?
I guess it was. I mean, I was a writer before I was a filmmaker, so I was always interested in using journalism as a means to expose things that were happening. And I tell this one story in the book of how a local business establishment, the Howard Johnson's Motor Lodge in town, had the manager there had a policy of not hiring African Americans or giving rooms to them at night. And so I sent people in to try and get a room or to try to get a job and photographed it and ran it in my paper. And it resulted in the Michigan Civil Rights Commission fining Howard Johnson's, at the time, I think it was $30,000 for this act of discrimination. And I did that for 10 years. I did stories like that for 10 years. I mean, that's my, you know, journalism background before I started to make my first film. And so, yes, I mean, I've always been curious about those who try to get away with hurting other people because they have power, because they have money, just because they can, and trying to find a way to you know, try to stand up for them. I mean, this what predates all this is probably goes back to childhood, where I was always the tallest and biggest kid in the class, and I did not like bullies, and the bullies left me alone because I was bigger and taller than them, but they picked on the, you know, the smaller ones, and I was always stepping in to break that up because I just wasn't fond of it, and I just thought it was really kind of unfair too. It's kind of a I don't know. It offended me on some level. Maybe that was just the way my parents raised me, but that sort of mentality was already in me at, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old.
Yeah, and you tell us a story which sounds a lot like your Oscar speech, in that when, I don't know how old you were, when you went to the Elks Club, you decided to
I went to Boys State. I think they have that here in New York. State has, they pick like 2 or 3 kids from every high school, and you go to Albany or Lansing, Michigan, the capital, to play government. And so I was picked for my high school, and I got there, and I'm around all these kids that like love to be in student council. And I didn't,
how old are you at this time?
I'm 16 or 17, I think. So I decided I don't want to play government, and I'm just going to sit in my dorm room at Michigan State, which is where they were holding it, and listen to records and eat junk food. And I ran out of junk food one day, and I went down the hall, and on the bulletin board above the junk food machine, it said that there was a speech contest on the make a speech of the life of Abraham Lincoln here at Boys State and win a prize. sponsored by the Elks Club. And I thought, well, that's kind of ironic because my dad had just gone to join the Elks Club and he wouldn't join because on the application form, it said right at the top, Caucasians only. Now, this is 1970, 71. I mean, we're in the 70s. You can still legally discriminate in America on the basis of race if it's a private club. Organization.
Right.
Yes. And so I just thought, you know, and here they're sponsoring a contest on Lincoln. Well, so I'm going to enter it. And so I enter it. I give this speech, just blasting the Elks Club, and I win. There's a speech teacher who's the judge, and he gives me the prize. And then he says, now you have to give it in front of all of Boys State. There's 3,000 boys here, and you've got to give this speech. And I was so freaked out. I was like so nervous. I was not that kind of public kind of person like that. But they told me I had to do it, and I did it. And it created a huge ruckus, and there was press there, and the head elk was there to give me the award. And I said at the end of the speech, I don't want your stinking prize. I walked off the stage, but most of the boys were cheering it. I kind of ran back to my dorm room and locked the door. And about an hour or two later, it had gone out on the AP wire. There was a reporter there. And there was a call from a producer from the CBS Evening News, Walter Cronkite, wanting me to come on the news that night. And I just told the guy no, because I'm thinking in my head, there's not enough Clearasil in the world to, you know, help get me to go on TV. So I didn't do it. But still, the story ran and it gained traction, and people started introducing bills to stop this private. And then there was a big court decision. The Justice or the Treasury Department withdrew nonprofit status from any private club that was going to discriminate. And within a year's time, roughly, racial discrimination at private clubs ended. And it was such an incredible lesson at the age of 16 or 17 that if you do just, I mean, to me, if you do just a little bit, like all I did was I just went down to get some junk food and I see this speech contest poster. I just give a little speech in East Lansing, Michigan. And a year later, you know, the snowball built and...
That you can express yourself and make a difference?
That things can actually happen. Because so much of what we're told from the cradle on is that you don't count. You can't make a difference. So don't rock the boat. Don't upset the apple cart. Don't, you know, it's better to go along so you can get along. I mean, that's kind of the message we're taught. And I learned at an early age, wow, if you just upset it just a little bit, actually some good things can happen. And it's a dangerous lesson to learn as a teenager, for me at least, because then I knew that just by following through on the things I believed in and doing a few things like that, good things possibly might happen.
We've only got about 30 seconds left. Are you working on a new film?
Well, I don't talk about it yet for all the obvious reasons, but... I am actually working on a project that's not a film that'll be out next year. So, and that's really all I can say at this time.
You don't have to tell us the details. I'm just assuming you're causing trouble.
but you'll be able to laugh a lot with this kind of trouble.
I've been speaking with Michael Moore about his latest book, Here Comes Trouble, Stories from My Life. It's published by Grand Central Publishing. Michael Moore will be signing books tonight at 7 at the Union Square Barnes & Noble. Great to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, and God bless public radio.